institutions of the priesthood, and they have been rather numerous. We're going to see some other sins that they were guilty of. They were guilty of them, and so were the people as well. Like people, like priests. That's what the Bible says. And we're going to see examples of it here in this second chapter. The sins that were coming among the priesthood spread out to the people as well. We want to look tonight, first of all, at the 10th verse. And really what you have here, beginning at verse 10 down through verse 12, is unlawful marriages reproved. And we want to talk about how that the Jews were to practice segregation. I realize that back in the 50s and the 60s, that word kind of got up in the air, and a lot of people got where they didn't like it one way or the other. But it is a very plain fact that the Jewish people were to remain segregated from other races. You cannot deny that if you're going to be honest with the Bible. And there was a reason for it, but we can't go into that. Let's begin here in the 10th verse that tells us how that the Jews were all of one ancestry. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against his brother? By profaning the covenant of our fathers. I don't believe that this verse is going to make much sense unless I point out something that is contrary to what Mr. Schofield says in his footnotes, if I remember correctly. This is another thing that he's wrong on. There are many things, especially the church and the like. But he says nowhere in the Old Testament are the Israelites called the sons of God. And while I realize that term sometime was applied to angels in the Old Testament, it seems to me when I read the Bible that the Israelites were also called the sons of Jehovah. And I want to see if I can prove that by the Bible. You see, God was the creator of the nation of Israel in a very special sense. That's one nation that he created. He brought it into being by a very special act. And because of that, there were certain things said about God and about Israel that's not said about any other people, as far as I can tell. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, and verse 6, do ye thus requite the Lord, O foolish people and unwise? Is not he thy father that would make them his sons? That hath brought thee? Hath he not made thee and established thee? Sometimes we think about George Washington being the father of our country, and I guess in many ways he was. But the father of Israel was God. That's what that verse just said. Now let's note another place in the Old Testament where you see this. In the book of Isaiah, and there are two verses here we want to look at, chapter 63, and verse 16. Doubtless thou art our father, though Abraham be ignorant of us, and Israel acknowledge us not. Thou, O Lord, art our father, our redeemer. Thy name is from everlasting. Note the words there. O Lord, thou, O Lord, art our father. God is spoken of there as the father of Israel. There was perhaps another sense in which we might say that the nation of Israel had one father. They all came from Abraham. Some people believe that the reference there is to Abraham, but I believe it's to God, the creator of the nation. But let me show you a verse that'll point that out too. The same book of Isaiah, chapter 51, verse 2. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bear you, for I called him along and blessed him and increased him. So God was the father and creator of Israel in a very special sense. And they all came from Abraham. And God, of course, called Abraham and made him a very special person unto him. Now, because God was the creator of the nation of Israel, he laid down certain laws for them that was not to be necessarily observed by other nations, but was to be observed by them alone. They were not to intermarry into other nations of people. Like I said, they were to remain segregated from all other nations. You might as well use that word because that's what it means. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 to 4. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Now watch. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. So then an Israelite could not marry people of a heathen nation. That is, not with God's approval. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. Israel was commanded there to practice segregation on peril of national destruction if they did not obey. That's how important it was. Look at that last verse there. God will be angry with them, and he'll destroy them. So it was a very serious offense for an Israelite to marry somebody of another nation, another nationality. It was prohibited. You'll find prohibitions like that in Joshua 23:12-13, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 and 2, and there are other places in the Bible where you can read it as well. But let me say this, looking back at our text there, in the sense of creation, we all came from Adam. We all have a common ancestry, and we cannot deny that fact. And so in the sense of creation, Adam is the father of all living, just like Abraham was the father of all the Israelites in a sense. Now in the sense of creation, Adam being the father of all living and Eve, the mother of all living, as the Bible says, in the sense of creation only, all mankind are brothers and sisters. We all came from a common stock. That's true in the sense of creation. That's what he's talking about there, because he said, "Hath not one God created us?" Remember, in the Psalms said, "It is the Lord that hath made us, and not we ourselves." That, I think, was referring to the same time. Now, let me show you a passage in the New Testament. You say, well, that's all out of the Old Testament. You can't put a lot of stock in that. Well, I believe you can. But look in the New Testament at Acts chapter 17 and verse 26. Talking about God, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth." So we all go back to Adam. Eve was the mother of all living. And so in that sense, in the sense of creation, all men and all women are brothers and sisters. Then you go on down and note still stronger language there as you get down to verse 29. "For as much then as we are the offspring of God." That again is in the sense of creation. "We ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's devices." I'll tell you right now, there's some things in the Bible about man that makes man a rather superior being when you think about it. Who in the world would want to claim ancestry with the brute? Because man was made in the image of God. Man in the original creation was the offspring of God. And to put the beast down on the same level with man is a terrible thing. A very terrible thing. So you see, all Israelites were brothers and sisters, and that's probably the thought there when he makes the statement there. Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother? By sinning against one another, they offended their common father and broke the family compact. They offended God, who was the father of the nation. That deal treacherously, every man against his brother. That was by perverting judgment, having respect of persons, and marrying strange heathenish wives. That's how they were doing it. And then he talked about there how that they had profaned the covenant of the fathers. Really, that covenant was their national charter. Their fathers there, of course, denotes the antiquity and the authority of the covenant. But they had lived in disobedience to the commandments of God. And they had profaned the old paths that their fathers had walked in from days of old. Then we come to the 11th verse where we have mention made of unholy marriages. In other words, they were unlawful marriages because they had intermarried with people of other nations, which was prohibited according to Deuteronomy 7. They were not to do it. And there are really two problems here. There was unholy marriages, and then there was unlawful divorces. And right now he's dealing with unholy marriages, but he goes on then to talk about unlawful divorces. But right now it's the unholy marriage there in verse 11. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Now, an abomination is something that God hates with a passion. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. Now, like I said a moment ago there, the Jews were to remain separated from these heathen nations that were around them, and they could not make a covenant with them. They could not engage in the marriage covenant or anything like that. But you know, if you read the history of the Israelitish nation, the first thing that you're made aware of is that most of the time they didn't obey that. They were constantly intermarrying these Canaanites and other people. And that's how they got themselves in a lot of trouble. They were not only marrying outside of their nation, but they were marrying outside of their religion. And it ended up usually that these heathens would corrupt the Israelites in the worship of the true God. And so the idolatrous connections was seen here as something that was profaning the name of Jehovah. Again, note the words there, Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. They had engaged in mixed marriages with idolaters. In other words, you had people worshiping the devil and people worshiping Jehovah. They were all together in the same household. That must have been a terrible sight. Now, what did it mean when it said Judah has profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved? Well, a heathen woman had entered in to the nation of Israel, into the community of God's chosen people. And it is always a terrible thing when those that profess holiness to the Lord profane themselves by yoking up with unbelievers, especially people that were of another religion, that worshipped another god. Then he talks there about a daughter of a strange god. Well, that was a woman that worshipped some kind of foreign deity. In other words, maybe she worshipped Moloch, or maybe she worshipped Ashtaroth, or some of the other heathen gods that are mentioned there in the Old Testament. And I pointed out earlier that the Israelites were called the sons of Jehovah. And I'm going to go back to that thought because Schofield doesn't believe that, but I do. And I'm going to take just one verse that makes it very plain. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 14, verse 1, ye are the children of the Lord your God. People that say that in the Old Testament the people were not called the children of God might ought to try that verse for size. It just about overturns the argument of a lot of people that I've heard. That's the Bible I'm reading. Ye are the children of the Lord your God. Ye shall not cut yourselves, nor make any baldness between your eyes for the dead. Then I think you see it again in the book of Proverbs. I thought of this verse only this afternoon, and another in the book of Isaiah. In the 14th chapter of the book of Proverbs, verse 26. In the fear of the Lord is strong confidence, and His children shall have a place of refuge. That's God's children. Look at the way that reads. His children shall have a place of refuge. Well, we may be tearing up theology books, but we're staying with the Bible. Look now in Isaiah chapter 43. This has to do, I believe, with the restoration of Israel in the last days. In Isaiah 43, look at the sixth verse there. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. So here again, you can see there that they were considered the sons of Jehovah, or the children of God and all of that. There was a saying that goes way back into the history of the Jewish people, very commonly uttered by the rabbis, that said, he that marries a heathen woman is as if he made himself son-in-law to an idol. That's exactly what they were doing here in this day and time. You know, we can pass from that scene in Israel and add this to it. Every woman that is not truly devoted to Christ is the daughter of a strange god and under the influence of the god of this world. I mean, it's just that simple. And so I guess the moral of the story here is, don't marry people that embrace a false and erroneous system of religion. You know, I think sometimes that a lot of homes have been reduced to shambles because of the conflict over religion. I've seen homes divide over religion. Now, what is the results of these unholy marriages? Well, it was the same thing in that day that it is today. First of all, there's domestic unhappiness. You just don't get along so well. You just don't hack it too well, like the old man said. Then there's a divided household, because one wants to go to this church and the other wants to go to that church. One believes this set of doctrines and the other believes another set of doctrines. In other words, one of them might believe in salvation by grace, the other one might believe in salvation by water baptism. Total contradiction. That always ends up with ill-trained children because they're confused by what they hear. And so you produce what we might call a generation of evildoers and maybe generations of evildoers sometimes. And then usually that always ends up with neglect of true religion. You see, that's what was happening to the Israelites. They were marrying these heathen women and they were turning their hearts away from Jehovah. They started to worship false gods, priests and the like. Say, well, fellow wouldn't be inclined to do that. Well, Solomon, the wisest man in the world, was the worst victim in the world of it. You surely don't think you're smarter than he is. And then these two conflicting religions oftentimes breed atheists. You ever thought about that? Here's a little boy and a little girl growing up in the home, and mama says this and daddy says that, and it sounds like it's all contradictory and foolish. So he just levels it all off and says, well, I'll clear the air. I'll just be an atheist. Maybe that's how a lot of them are born. You know, an evil marriage can be the devil's chain that binds the soul to everlasting wretchedness and misery. That's what these fellows discovered in that day and time. And then there's very strong words that follow here regarding mixed marriages that will be punished. And if you're a pupil or a teacher, you'll get the same punishment. That's more or less what it says to me there. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts. So, what does it mean there when it said the Lord will cut off the man that doeth this? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that God's going to liquidate him or exterminate him, but it means that he would transgress the law of Israel and therefore would be deprived of his position as a citizen of Israel. And he would be put away from the covenant people, and no one would be left to maintain his name and family in Israel. So in a sense, he would be cut off. He'd lose all identity with the nation. I believe it was Matthew Henry that said it meant to be cut off from Israel and from Jerusalem and not to be written among the living people of that day and time. In other words, they didn't recognize you as a citizen of their country anymore. You were in a state of exile or banishment, if you want to think of it that way. And it said that the master and the scholar would suffer the same. In other words, the teacher and the pupil would get the same punishment. You know, blind leaders have blind followers. Wasn't that what Christ said in Matthew 15:14? Said, if the blind lead the blind, they both shall fall into the ditch. And to put that in somewhat of a spiritual context, if a blind preacher is leading some blind followers, they'll both fall into hell. That's really what I think he meant. And then the last part of that verse seems to have bothered some, but I think it has a simple meaning. And him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts, he's going to be cut off. So here's a priest, he's engaged now in this unholy marriage with a heathen woman who's turned his heart away from the Lord. No wonder he can't worship. No wonder he can't offer the proper offerings down in the temple. No wonder he lets the blind and the lame and all that come down and be offered by Israelites. His heart has been turned away from God. And so he said, well, I've done wrong. I believe I'll bring an atonement down for my sins. Just one thing wrong. God didn't have any atonement for sins like that. So there wasn't any way he could atone for his sins. You'll go there in Ezra chapter 10, verse 18, in the book of Nehemiah chapter 13. You'll find that Ezra and Nehemiah drove out the priests. Drove them out of Israel that married these heathen women. They would not allow them. They were cut off. Nehemiah pulled some of them's hair out and beat them up and drove them out. Maybe you might not like his methods, but he got the job done. You'll have to say that for him. You might want to complain about the way he handled the situation, but he cleaned up the house of the Lord and he threw some fellas out. Literally went down there and what you might say, packed up their duds and threw them out the door because they had engaged in marriage with these heathen women. Then we go to the next section here, beginning at verse 13 through 16, and we certainly will not finish that tonight. We have unlawful divorces condemned. There was a scriptural grounds for a divorce, according to Deuteronomy 24:1-4. Moses said that if your wife was guilty of adultery, sexual impurity of some sort, you could put her away without sin. That was the law in Israel. Deuteronomy 24:1-4 makes that very plain. But what he's dealing with here is unlawful divorces, and he's condemning them in no uncertain terms. Because what was happening, I guess to put it like I sometimes see it happen today. Here was a man as he got older. He's a priest, and it was speaking here mostly about priests at this time. And he looked at his wife and said, you know, she's getting kind of old and gray. I don't think she looks too good anymore. I seen me a young girl the other day that looked just about like I'd like to have. So tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to divorce this old woman that I got, and I'm going to get me one of these young whippersnappers just like I want. And so he put his wife away. No grounds for putting her away. She hadn't done anything wrong. It was an unlawful divorce, but he put her away anyway. And by the time of Malachi, believe me, divorce was pretty liberal in Israel. No wonder the Lord said what he did over there in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19. He pointed out how that they had so corrupted the teaching of the Old Testament. They'd gone away beyond anything that Moses ever dreamed of or imagined, I'm sure. So that's really what was happening. And so as we look there at the 13th verse, these women that had been put away unlawfully, in other words, they hadn't done anything to cause their husband to put them away, they began to cry out to the Lord for justice for this evil that had been heaped upon them. That's what we're seeing there in verse 13. And this have ye done again. So this is the second charge. The first charge was unholy marriages. Now it's unlawful divorce. And this have ye done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears. That is, these women that had been unlawfully put away, with weeping and with crying out, inasmuch that he regardeth not the offering anymore, nor receiveth it with goodwill at your hands. So here the women are pictured as it were, covering the very altar of the Lord with tears, crying out for judgment, crying out for vengeance. Now, if people do you wrong, you may obtain redress of your grievance at the throne of God. He hears the cry of the hurt and the helpless. And here's proof of it. And these tears had more or less just covered the altar. And God was moved by their crying. And because he was so moved by the crying of these women unlawfully put away, he wouldn't accept the offering of the men that brought it down there to the tabernacle and to the temple. He wouldn't have it. In other words, he said, your conduct does not permit you to bring an offering. I will not accept it. And I tell you right now, proper relationships in the home have a great deal to do with the worship of the true God. Over there in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, it says that the man and the woman are to live together in tranquility and happiness, lest their prayers be hindered. Well, evidently there were a lot of prayers being hindered here, because these wives that had been unlawfully put away, and their husbands had taken these heathen wives in, they're crying out to God, and God will not accept the offering of these Israelite men. They bring it down to the priest, and God won't have it because of the sin in their life. He won't have it. That's what's meant there about inasmuch that he regardeth not the offering anymore, or receiveth it with goodwill at your hands. You can bring it down, you can offer it, God won't have it. He won't have it. Sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. That's what the Bible said, book of Proverbs. And then they had the audacity, after putting away their wife for no reason whatsoever and marrying a woman of a false religion, to say, well, now, this what's so bad about what we've done anyway? Sometime, I think it must have been 20th century America. Listen to what they said there in verse 14. Yet ye say, now this is what the Lord said. Now they got, here's what they said about it. Yet ye say, wherefore? And then it seems like the prophet Malachi answers their question. Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, yet she is thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. Now let's look at that. First of all, they say, wherefore? Well, they had the gall to ask God what was wrong with what they were doing. Why don't you accept our offerings when we bring them down? Well, we haven't done all these bad things you think we've done. And so Malachi comes back and he gives an answer there. He says, let me point out first of all to you fellows that God instituted marriage. He ordained matrimony. Adam actually set it up for the race over there in Genesis 2 and 24. When he said that a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. He's talking there about marriage. And so he said, the God that instituted marriage is also a witness to every marriage covenant that is made. And in case you don't believe he is, read Genesis 31, 49 to 50. Because over there it plainly says God is a witness to the marriage covenant. You know, sometimes when people march down the aisle of the church to get married and they hold hands and the preacher goes through the ceremony and all of that, you got your parents there and your relatives and your friends. They're all witnessing the scene. Two of them at least will have to sign the license to make them legal and all of that. But you know, there's another witness there that a lot of people don't think about. God's there. God's there. Father and mother may hear the marriage vows. Sister and brother might hear the marriage vows or somebody else. But more important than anybody, God is a witness to that marriage covenant. And that's what he's bringing out here. So he witnesses those pledges of fidelity. I'll be loyal to you till death do us part. God's a witness to that. And whenever violation comes about, he's a witness to that too. He watches for both. So God is a witness to our covenants, and he's also a witness to the breaches of our covenants. I guess we might say that what we say we're going to do, God pays attention to. And if we don't do it, he pays attention to our failures too. That's why the Bible says it's better not to make a vow than it is to make it and break it. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us that. But I want you to note here in this 14th verse, and I'm going to try to summarize it where it'll be easier to understand. There were really four charges that God brought against them for the evil that they had done. Very important things. First of all, the woman that they had unlawfully put away for no reason whatever, she had done nothing wrong, She just got divorced because the man didn't like her, thought she'd got too old or something. Said, she is thy wife. That meant bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh, the nearest and dearest of all relations that he would ever have in the world. As a matter of fact, that man and that woman, by getting married, had become one flesh. That speaks of the marriage union. Then the next thing that he points out, she is the wife of thy youth, your first choice, with whom you have long lived. The Bible puts a lot of stress on the wife of youth and the husband of youth and all of that. For instance, back in the book of Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 16 and 17, to deliver thee from the strange woman, even from the stranger, which flattereth with her words, which forsaketh the God of her youth, and forgetteth the covenant of her God. And then you go on over in this same book of Proverbs to chapter 5, and while Solomon uses, shall I say, a bit of crouch language here, what he's saying is very plain and blunt. Let's start at verse 15. Drink waters out of thine own cistern, and running water out of thine own well. In other words, live with your own wife, to put it plainly. Let thy fountain be dispersed abroad, and the rivers of waters in the street. Let them be thine own, and not the strangers with thee. In other words, let the kids be yours, not somebody else's. Let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and the pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? The wife of youth, the darling of your early years. Then the third thing that's pointed out here, she is thy companion. She's shared joys and griefs with you. She's been the one that you've delighted to be in the company of. And God appointed her to be your helpmeet in this life. And then the fourth thing is, she is the wife of thy covenant. The word covenant here has to do with the marriage covenant. Very clearly so. John Gill, Matthew Henry, almost all commentators say that's the reference. Not the covenant of Levi, but it's somewhat like the covenant of Levi. Now, according to the Bible, if a man marries a wife and she is faithful to him, he cannot, according to the Scripture, be loose from her. He cannot break that covenant that made them one flesh. And just to show you that the Bible is pretty plain on what I'm talking about, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 32, "But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication," there is one exception, sexual impurity, "that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." Then if you want to look at Mark's account, and he's writing a lot to the Gentiles and uses language somewhat appropriate to them, look at verse 11 and 12 of the 10th chapter of Mark. "And he saith unto them, whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery." Paul taught the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 and 11. And all of them are arguing there for the permanency of marriage, for a person to be married and to stay married and not to break that marriage off and all of that. Now, when it says she is the wife of thy covenant, that is another way of saying there is an oath of God between the two of you. You vowed before God to be faithful to one another. There is an oath of God between you. And you know, back in the Old Testament time and even in the early New Testament times, the heathens looked upon marriage as being sacred. Sometimes just read what they believed about it. You'll be shocked. They were not so bad as you may think in their theology. And they had guards against marriages to keep them intact and all of that. And even some of the most remote tribes of the world They have their standards. I'm interested sometimes listening to people over in New Guinea, these natives over there, aborigines and the like, and all the people that's in these remote parts of South America and even Africa, how that they have what almost amounts to the moral law of God, and they're obeying it. They probably couldn't tell you why, but somehow it's written in their hearts, like the Bible said. And they have very strong feelings about marriage, if you'll even study the antiquity of the ancient nations and all of that. And then it said, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. They had put away their wife for no reason whatsoever in order to take another, and evidently must have hated the first or disliked her to some degree, or they wouldn't have put her away. There is one very serious message that comes out of this lesson tonight. People that have taken the marriage vows would do well to review those from time to time and think about the seriousness of that oath they took before God. And they ought to make a conscience out of performing what they promised in the presence of God and many witnesses they would do. I think that's very important. You say, well, preacher, this is an awful sermon to me because I've already been married and divorced, and so I'm in trouble. What do I do? Well, you just have to do the best you can, just like a lot of people have had to do. And there'll be more about this in the next part of the lesson here. And bear in mind that he's talking here about unlawful divorces. And what made them unlawful was really two things in the days of Malachi. First of all, they put away their wife without any just cause. There was no grounds for the divorce, none whatever. They didn't obey Deuteronomy 24:1-4. The second thing was, rather than marrying another Israelitish woman, they went out and married a heathen woman, violated another one of the laws of the Old Testament. So they had two problems there. They had unholy marriages, and they had unlawful divorces. And God condemned both as being wrong. Well, that's our lesson for tonight. Let us stand, and we shall sing.